Today is January 25th, 2023. I want to talk about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, and I also want to talk about another instance of U.S. interference, this time in Myanmar. I'm going to start with Russian military operations in Ukraine and the West's desire to escalate this. Now, with all of this fighting taking place, Ukraine's offensives clearly long ago having ground to a halt. Russia now on the offensive, Ukraine losing ground. And remember, at the same time, every single month, Russia carries out several missile and drone strikes targeting the infrastructure of Ukraine, degrading the power grid. While all of this is taking place, you have articles like this from the BBC. Top Ukrainian officials quit an anti-corruption drive. It says a top advisor, four deputy ministers, and five regional governors left their posts. And then the article lists the president's deputy head of office, the deputy defense minister, the deputy prosecutor general, the deputy minister of development of communities and territories, the deputy minister for social policy, and the regional governors of Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporozhye, Kiev, Sumy, and Kherson. They're all gone. And this follows Alexei Arestovych, an advisor to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky and dubbed the chief spin doctor of the Ukrainian government. He's gone. And then you had the interior minister and his whole team on a helicopter that crashed and they all died. So all of that has happened recently. There is a video by the Duran, Alex Christoforou, and Alexander Mikuris. They go into detail on that. I'm not going to go over that again. They did an excellent job. The link to that video will be in the video description below. But essentially, they're talking about the possibility that this is more of a purge. They're calling this an anti-corruption drive in the BBC. Highly unlikely that you're going to do something like that in the middle of a war. Much more likely that this is a purge. A purge by whom and for what reason? The Duran goes over all of the possibilities. No one knows for sure, not yet. In that same video by the Duran, Alex and Alexander go into speculation as to why the U.S. and its allies are talking about sending main battle tanks, where those main battle tanks may actually go rather than to the Ukrainians, who most certainly are not going to be able to make effective use out of them. And the idea is that they have to stage all of this equipment in Poland anyway. Perhaps it's going to be used by Polish troops, Baltic state troops, an incursion originating in Poland going into Western Ukraine. And I have talked about the prospect of the U.S., NATO, going into Western Ukraine and creating a buffer zone. I've talked about this since the special military operation began in February last year. This is a possibility that I think we should keep a very close eye on. Again, watch the video and listen to Alex and Alexander go through the reasoning and all of the factors that are leading them to consider this possibility. On the other hand, we have to remember that all of the same problems that face the idea of sending main battle tanks and all of this other NATO armor to Ukraine, all of these same problems existed when the U.S. and their allies sent things like the HIMARS, M270s, and M777 towed howitzers. They had all of the same problems. They would never be able to get the number of artillery pieces necessary to match Russia, and they would never be able to use them effectively on the battlefield because of constraints in training, and also because none of these weapon systems are meant to go on the battlefield and fight in a conflict on their own. They are supposed to be part of a combined arms force, and you're supposed to include sufficient amounts of artillery, armor, infantry, and air power, and Ukraine doesn't have any of these things. Not nearly in the numbers that they need to fight effective modern combined arms warfare. But let's get into the topic of main battle tanks. I had said previously that all of this back and forth over Leopards and Abrams, this was all theater, and that eventually Germany would definitely be sending Leopards and the US would most likely send Abrams. Now we have this from the BBC. US and Germany ready to send tanks to Ukraine, reports. And the article says, US President Joe Biden's administration is expected to announce plans to send at least 30 M1 Abrams tanks. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has also reportedly decided to send at least 14 Leopard 2 tanks. He is set to speak in Parliament on Wednesday morning. The article admits that it could take months to send these tanks. Yes, at a minimum, it will take months to train Ukrainians on the rudimentary operation of these vehicles, create the supply chains necessary to sustain them on the battlefield, at least. And that's just to get them rolling on the battlefield and possibly firing their gun in the right direction. This is all analysis by Jonathan Beale, a BBC defense correspondent. It says Ukraine is still unlikely to get the 300 modern main battle tanks it says it needs to win the war. I wouldn't bet on that. I think they're going to continuously increase this number. But if half a dozen Western nations can provide 14 tanks, then that would bring the total to nearly 100, which could make a difference. No, it cannot, and I'll explain why. Western tanks, including the UK's Challenger 2, Germany's Leopard 2, and the US-made Abrams, are all seen as superior to their Soviet-era counterparts, like the ubiquitous T-72. And that is not true, and this is all based on the performance of the US M1 Abrams in Iraq. And the situation in Iraq is entirely different than the situation in Ukraine right now. And the T-72s that the US fought and destroyed in Iraq are completely different than the T-72s and also T-90s and T-80s that Russia is using in Ukraine right now. Now, in my last update, I talked about this Twitter thread by Lieutenant General Mark Hertling of the US Army, retired, and he is talking about all of the actual problems of sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. And I'm not going to read through this again, but I will go over the points briefly. He says the M1 Abrams requires long periods of training, and it's not just to teach the crew to operate the tank itself, it's also to teach the tanks how to fight together as a unit. He says the M1 Abrams requires the most training among both NATO and Soviet era tanks in terms of firing the main gun. And the M1 Abrams driver needs a lot of training because a poorly trained driver is going to destroy the engine. It is a multi-fuel turbine engine. And once you break it, you have to replace it, which is not a trivial task on a battlefield in Eastern Ukraine or Western Russia, depending on your point of view. Now, regarding maintenance, he points out that you cannot just have a Ukrainian jet engine technician work on an Abrams engine just because it's a turbine engine. He points out that you have to have an experienced and certified technician that has knowledge and is certified specifically on the Abrams engine. And he points out that it's true that Iraq and Saudi Arabia operate M1 Abrams tanks, but Iraq had a 5-year training program before they began using them, and Saudi Arabia had a 7-year training program. As I've pointed out many times before, it takes years to properly integrate a heavy weapon system like this into your military. It took Ukraine years to integrate the Bayraktar TB2 drone into their military, and it still made no difference. We don't hear about TB2 drones anymore. Now, in another video by Alexander McCurris of the Duran, and again, it will be linked to in the video description below, he talks about this article from 1945, Ukraine won't get Leopard 2 or M1 Abrams tanks, does it matter? This is by Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, so another US military officer with experience specifically in armor. And well, Now we learn that Ukraine is going to get Leopards and Abrams. But he describes all of the problems that Ukraine is going to face trying to use these, and why they're not going to be as effective as people seem to think. He says, will these high-tech tanks, if Ukraine eventually gets them, transform the Ukrainian armed forces into a modern force that can drive Russia out later this spring? The chances aren't as great as many believe. And then he says, in Desert Storm, US M1A1 Abrams tanks wiped out Saddam Hussein's fleets of Soviet-made T-72s. And again, the American Abrams-led invasion in 2003 revealed the T-72 was no match for US tanks. And truly, the American tanks were witheringly successful. During Desert Storm, for example, the US and its coalition partners destroyed more than 3,000 Iraqi tanks. Saddam's armored forces, however, did not destroy even a single Abrams tank. It is understandable, then, why anyone would want to have an Abrams or equivalent tank, especially when it has proven so effective against exactly the type of tanks Russia has. And Alexander, in his video, points out that the T-72 tanks in Iraq during these two conflicts he mentions are completely different than the T-72s that are being used in Ukraine right now by Russia. These T-72s have been heavily modernized. They have modern computerized fire control systems, they have night and thermal imaging optics, and they have explosive reactive armor, which is a huge upgrade, a step up from the steel armor that the T-72 was originally designed with, and which was what Iraq had on the battlefield. So all three of these factors make a huge difference. And you will see why in just a moment, because Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis is going to explain what is most important in a tank battle. He says, in tank fights, the side that accurately fires first almost always wins. In Desert Storm, we almost always fired first, and because of our training, almost never missed. But when the Iraqi gunners got off a shot, it was rarely on target. The results were fatal for them. Now, the T-72 tanks that Russia has in Ukraine, they're going to be able to see Ukrainian tanks as soon or sooner than Ukrainian tanks will see them. They have computerized fire control systems. When they aim a shot, they're almost certainly going to hit on the first try. If people remember the video I did about Wally, the super sniper from Canada, his last mission in Ukraine was trying to hunt a Russian modern main battle tank. He had a team of four. Two of the four teammates were killed instantly when a Russian tank saw them and killed them both on the first shot. He never managed to hit that Russian tank with his Javelin because these are modernized T-72s. They have modern optics. They can see you surely before you see them, day or night, in any weather condition. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis points out another extremely important factor, perhaps the most important factor. The US crewmen were highly trained as individuals. In my unit, tank drivers, loaders, gunners, and vehicle commanders had all mastered their individual jobs, then for more than a year before battle, had conducted considerable time training as platoons, then company level, and later we trained in squadron and eventually regimental levels. No one could have been more ready to fight than we were. Think about what he's saying. He's not saying that all of these people only trained for a year and then they were capable of what they achieved. They had already mastered the skills of operating a tank and operating a tank individually along with other tanks as part of a unit. They had already mastered these skills, and then they specifically trained for a whole year for this operation. If you remember the build-ups to Desert Storm and also the invasion in 2003, these were extended periods of time, and the US military used this time to train their forces specifically for the invasion. And then he continues about the Iraqis. This is what he says. Iraq had done virtually none of these things. We later discovered their crew members had minimum training, had rarely, if ever, fired their main guns in training, did very little unit level training, and their maintenance programs, far more important in tank operations than commonly understood, was virtually non-existent. In short, the T-72 operators were poorly trained while our side was highly trained. And that made a huge difference. Now, this is what he says. Listen to what he says very carefully. Here is a little known truth. If the Iraqis had the same M1 A1s that we had, or if we had been outfitted with the same T-72s Iraq had, we still would have won, because ultimately it is the man operating the tools of war that wins, not the tools themselves. Without question, the Abrams is superior in every way to any Soviet-era tank, but without proper training and maintenance, even an M1 can be defeated. And even with all of those things, an M1 can still be defeated. As I pointed out, in Yemen, Saudi Arabia has lost M1 Abrams tanks to irregular Yemeni forces using Russian-made anti-tank weapons. I pointed out how Israel, highly trained crews, well-supported logistically on the battlefield and supported in terms of combined arms warfare, they lost their vaunted Merkava tanks to Hezbollah forces, again, using Russian-made anti-tank weapons. The same goes for Leopard 2 tanks used by Turkey in northern Syria. These were all well-trained tank crews, supported logistically in ways that Ukraine could only dream of, and benefiting from combined arms warfare, air power, infantry fighting vehicles, artillery of all kinds. They benefited from all of these advantages, and their tanks were still being destroyed on the modern battlefield by Russian-made anti-tank weapons. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis also says, tanks cannot fight alone or they die, often to anti-tank missiles. And this is something I've talked about many times. These Western weapons were designed to be used in combined arms warfare, not on their own. The HIMARS was never supposed to be running around on the battlefield by itself. The M777 was never meant for the type of mission that the U.S. has thrown it into in Ukraine. U.S. tanks in Iraq, in addition to fighting poorly trained, poorly equipped Iraqi soldiers, they fought with artillery support, air power, and infantry support. They had all of these things working in their favor, and they had trained for this. It was well-rehearsed combined arms warfare that they used against poorly trained, poorly equipped, poorly prepared Iraqi troops. This is not the same situation that Ukraine is going to be using these tanks in. And then he concludes by saying, Zelensky's troops already have a significant number of tanks equivalent to their opposition. Their battles will be won or lost based on how well they train, on what they have, how much unit level capacity they develop, and how well they maintain their tanks. Flatly stated, Zelensky's war against Russia will not turn on whether or not he gets Abrams and Leopards. And this is absolutely true. And this is something that if the US and Germany and Poland and the UK, if this is something that they really go through with, we're all going to see this unfold on the battlefield. Ukraine is going to use these tanks in the exact same way they've been using their tanks. They rush toward Russian defensive positions. They send as many men and machines as possible toward a specific location. They try to disperse their forces across a wide front so that this massive advantage Russia has in firepower has to be divided and spread out. And they could only kill and destroy so many men and destroy so many machines. And they hope that enough gets through and closes that distance and begins inflicting losses on Russian forces, which are adverse to any type of loss, especially heavy losses, and are adverse to the prospect of being encircled. They will withdraw. The problem with this, as we now see in retrospect of the Kherson and Kharkov offensives, is that as Russia withdraws, they maintain their fighting capacity. All of those men, all of that equipment is preserved. They can fight on later. Ukraine, on the other hand, even when they are successful with this strategy, they suffer immense losses. We're talking brigades and brigades worth of men and machines. 5 to 7 brigades around Kherson, 2 to 3 brigades around Kharkov. As Lieutenant General Mark Hertling has pointed out, and as Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis has explained in great detail, there is absolutely no way for Ukraine to use these tanks as effectively as the U.S. used them in Iraq. And when Ukrainians go into battle with these Western main battle tanks, they're not going to find themselves in a situation where the factors on the battlefield were so lopsidedly in their favor as the U.S. did in Iraq. In many ways, it's going to be the exact opposite. And this point that Lieutenant Colonel Davis made about how if the Iraqis had our tanks and we had their tanks, we still would have won because of our training. And not just that, but because they were also employing combined arms warfare, they had air cover, they had artillery support, all of these factors would have meant they still would have won. We're actually going to see that in practice if Ukrainians are given these tanks. And let's continue looking at this. Russia ground these offensives to a halt in Kharkov and Kherson. Then, what have they done since then? They've mobilized 300,000 reservists, and they have begun creating huge defensive works in the south and also in the east. Remember this New York Times article, defenses carved into the earth. Russia is building a vast network of trenches, traps, and obstacles to slow Ukraine's momentum. Will it work? Well, Ukraine has no more momentum. They're going backwards on the battlefield. And just scroll through, look at the images, all of these lines. These are all trenches and obstacles and tank traps that Russia is laying out. And so they're going to have all of the advantages that they had before, and now they're augmenting it with these defensive works and the addition of 300,000 reservists to man these defenses. It's actually going to be much worse for Ukraine this time, even with these Western main battle tanks. This is from the New York Times. Pentagon will increase artillery production sixfold for Ukraine. Wow, that sounds like a lot. The Army's top acquisition official says production of the 155 millimeter shells badly needed by Kiev will rise to 90,000 a month in 2 years. So, well, 2 years is a long time for Ukraine, considering what's going on right now on the ground. But 90,000, what does that mean? At 6,000 shells a day, which is what Ukraine claims at least they had been firing every single day, that's half a month. So, okay, the U.S. is going to make 90,000 a month. Well, Ukraine needs double that just to fire 6,000 rounds a day, which is still much less than what Russia is firing every single day. And that assumes that all 90,000 rounds goes straight to Ukraine and not to other places they're badly needed, like for U.S. troops to train with or U.S. allies who need to replenish their stocks. So this, you know, 2 years, this is a problem that is going to be a problem for years to come. Here's another article from CNN. Ukraine wants longer range missiles as Russia learns from its mistakes. It says Ukrainian officials say the Russians are learning from their battlefield mistakes and making it harder for Ukraine's missiles to hit their ammunition depots and logistics hubs. That's why they say Ukraine needs longer range missiles that can reach inside Russia. Everything is moved to the southern regions through the Crimean Peninsula from logistical hubs in the Russian region of Rostov. Russia's logistics system is 80 to 120 kilometers from the front line, which means Ukraine needs longer range strike systems to target them. So of course, what they're talking about is HIMARS and the M270s and these, they're called guided multiple launch rocket systems, GMLRS. They're these GPS guided rockets that Ukraine has been using with the HIMARS and the M270s that we were told turned the tide of the conflict. Now they need to turn the tide again. And what this article is also saying is that Ukraine is asking for ATACMS, and this is Army Tactical Missile System, in case you're wondering what it stands for. And it has a range of 300 kilometers. And this is what they've been asking all along. And so we see the U.S. sending M1 Abrams. They said they were never going to send. I have a funny feeling that ATACMS cannot be far behind. I think it's only a matter of time before ATACMS are sent. But here's the problem. If Russia has already adapted to Ukraine's use of these Gimlers with a range of 70 kilometers, don't you think that they're going to also likewise adapt to Ukraine's use of a missile with a 300 kilometer range? I think they will. And there's also another problem. Ukraine, because of their heavy use of these guided rockets, are depleting US stockpiles. Just like with artillery, they want to expand production of these guided rockets, but that is going to take years to do. This is from Lockheed Martin. Gimlers, the precision fires go-to rounds. The right precision fire solution for every mission. And it says more than 40,000 guided MLRS rockets produced to date and climbing. Okay, so that is around how many Gimlers have been produced, between 40, probably 50,000. The production rates have been between 2,000 and 3,000 rockets per year. This is an article by The Drive, The War Zone. Are there enough guided rockets for HIMARS to keep up with Ukraine war demand? Ukraine is burning through guided artillery rockets to great effect, but even with tens of thousands stockpiled, the U.S. can find its supplies under pressure. So they're admitting the same problem that I have just told you about, and they're talking about increasing production from between 2,000 to 3,000 a year to 4,000 by when? By 2027. So again, another problem that isn't even going to really be solved a couple of years from now. They will expand production, but even a couple of years from now, they will still have the same problem of not being able to build enough. If this is the problem you're having with these guided rockets that are very numerous, what about ATACMS, which are much less numerous? So here, from Lockheed, who also makes them, they're making a lot of money from this war. Lockheed Martin delivers new production ATACMS missiles. This is from 2017, keep that in mind. But it says Lockheed Martin has produced more than 3,800 ATACM missiles with more than 20 years of on-time deliveries. More than 600 ATACM missiles have been fired in combat. So 40 to 50,000 Gimlers, 3,800 ATACMs. You see the disparity in the number that are available, potentially available. And then if you think about it, 20 years, 3,800, it's about 190 per year, but usually much less. In this article, 2017, they talk about only 124 being made that year. So if Ukraine is having a problem with guided rockets, they're most certainly going to have a major problem with these longer range missiles. If Russia is able to adapt to the HIMARS, the guided rockets, they're also going to adapt to the missiles. And you say, well, Brian, if they have to push their logistics and everything back 300 kilometers, well, that's still better than what Ukraine has to do. They have to push it back 1,000 kilometers. There's nowhere in Ukraine that is safe from Russian cruise missiles and drones. Their Iskander missile system has a range of 400 to 500 kilometers. We also have to remember that none of these capabilities that the West is talking about, just even talking about giving Ukraine, these are not capabilities that Russia doesn't already have in abundance. So if you know, we're imagining that Ukraine is going to use ATACMS to disrupt the logistics and the rear of Russian forces. Well, what do you think Russian forces have been doing with Iskander cruise missiles, Garand-2, and their own multiple launch rocket systems, including guided rockets? What do you think they've been doing this entire time and on a much larger scale? So This is the fantastical thinking. We're hearing about tanks and missiles. We're even starting to hear about F-16s again. This is the fantastical thinking from a West that is desperate, that is not even in touch with reality. And they are talking about doing things that are just going to stretch this conflict out longer. And I don't know if they noticed, but it seems to only be making Russia stronger, justifying decisions in Moscow that they could never justify during peacetime, to increase military industrial output, to mobilize more men for the military. All of these things are now possible because of the West's belligerence toward Russia through Ukraine. Now, in addition to this U.S. proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, the U.S. is destabilizing other nations around the world, including along the border with China. I showed you this map in my last update. We were talking about Pakistan and Southwest Pakistan, Balochistan, where the U.S. is backing terrorists who are attacking infrastructure and also Chinese engineers, Pakistani security, and Chinese diplomats. All of that is going on in Pakistan. Myanmar is a country in Southeast Asia. It shares a border with China. Chinese Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure runs through Myanmar, including a very important pipeline that allows China to send hydrocarbons to Myanmar, across Myanmar into China, rather than going through this strait, which the U.S. has openly talked about closing, specifically to cut off hydrocarbon flows to China. Let's talk about what the U.S. is doing to Myanmar. And I've explained it a little bit in the past. I have many videos regarding the situation in Myanmar, and I will put a few of them, the most important ones, in the video description below. Essentially, the U.S. has been backing opposition groups, including militants, in Myanmar for decades, since Myanmar got its independence from the British after World War II. From 2016 to 2021, they actually managed to get a client regime government into power. It was headed by Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy. In 2021, the military ousted her from power. She literally had British and Australian citizens in her inner circle working on rewriting the constitution, rewriting other laws in Myanmar, directing Myanmar's economic policies. I've covered all of this, and I've shared all of the evidence and documentation associated with these claims. The United States has poured millions and millions of dollars into Myanmar. If you go to the U.S. government's National Endowment for Democracy, this is how they fund opposition parties and separatist groups around the world. This is for Myanmar, which they're still calling Burma. This is from 2021. And if you scroll down, you can see how many programs are being funded. And any one of these programs, if you look at the details, you will see that, say, if China or Russia were funding a similar program in the United States, it would be immediately perceived as political interference, and everyone involved would be arrested for subversion and treason, because it is absolutely interference. And Aung San Suu Kyi herself has literally traveled to Washington, D.C. to pick up awards from the National Endowment for Democracy. This is one of the more transparent examples of the U.S. meddling in another country's internal political affairs and trying to install a puppet regime into power. Now, of course, because Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure runs through Myanmar, Myanmar and China are close trade partners. The goal here is to either turn Myanmar against China, and if that fails, the military throws your client regime out of power, then just burn everything down, attack the infrastructure, which has already happened. US-backed opposition groups have physically attacked Chinese infrastructure in Myanmar, and they're just in general trying to burn the whole country down at this point. The military is running the country since the coup in 2021. They want to have an election and at least superficially transfer control over to a civilian administration. Why Southeast Asia allows itself to be constrained by this concept of Western-style democracy, which was imposed upon them. It wasn't adopted because it was the best way to run a country. Clearly it isn't. It was imposed upon them, and they feel the need to go through the motions to avoid pressure from the U.S. and from the so-called international community, which really is just the West. So they are trying to organize these elections. They want to transfer power to a civilian administration, but the U.S. opposition is disrupting this. They are carrying out terrorist attacks against anyone and anything involved in the election. So we have this from Voice of America, U.S. government-funded media. Uncertainty shrouds Myanmar's elections, and says a Myanmar junta spokesperson has told VOA's Burmese service that there is uncertainty over whether general elections will be held this year due to what he calls issues regarding voter registration and opposition attacks surging across the country, which they admit are taking place. When pressed on the subject, Major General Za Min Tan said, "I can't say for sure right now. All I can say is that we are working hard to hold elections this year. However, there are various subversive activities," he said in a telephone interview. Za Min Tan appeared to be referring to Myanmar's parallel government in exile, known as the National Unity Government, or NUG, and other resistance groups that have emerged since the junta's seizure of power in February 2021. The takeover led to the ouster of the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi and triggered widespread street demonstrations. Well, you saw Aung San Suu Kyi going to Washington, D.C., associating with the NED, and the NED funneling millions and millions of dollars every single year into Myanmar's opposition. So was she really democratically elected, or was Myanmar's democratic process hijacked by the U.S. and the results of any sort of genuine election overturned by the U.S.'s interference? An obvious question to answer, really. So just like the U.S. did in Venezuela, or for a time in Libya and Syria, they have these fake exiled governments that claim to represent the people in a country they're not even located in. And the U.S. will either work to try to get them recognized as the official government of that country, or they will just outright recognize them as the official government of that country. In Venezuela, Juan Guaido was a really good example of that. And just to drive home the point that it is a completely U.S.-controlled opposition, I just want to show you a really quick example of some of the type of people who are in this parallel fake government that's not even in Myanmar. So this is their official website, National Unity Government of the Republic of the Union of Myanmar. And if we scroll down, there's the different ministers, and here's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So this is her bio on the official website of the NUG, and they talk about her being a fellow in the Reagan Facel Democracy Fellow Program of the National Endowment for Democracy. That's what they admit in her official bio on the NUG's website. And then if you cross-reference that, you will see that on the National Endowment for Democracy's website, there is a whole page dedicated to Ms. Xin Mar Ang. And if you read her mini bio here carefully, you will notice that she co-founded the Yagun School of Political Science, an NED-funded institution that educates young activists in the values of democracy. I mean, educates people in Myanmar to vote the way Washington wants them to vote. This is how transparent U.S. meddling in Myanmar is. It's never mentioned by articles in Voice of America or the BBC. If it was the other way around, if a nation was interfering in the U.S.'s internal political affairs this way, or a nation allied to the United States, it would never be acceptable, and we would never hear the end of it. And yes, this is something that the Western media, in a very concerted manner, covers up. Just as the United States maneuvered a client regime into power in Ukraine, and then had Ukraine irrationally cut all of its ties to Russia, destroying Ukraine's economy, and then using Ukraine as a battering ram against Russia, they're trying to do the exact same thing across all of Southeast Asia, not just Myanmar. Myanmar's military fought back. They ousted this client regime. They jailed Aung San Suu Kyi. But as you can see, the U.S. is still backing violent subversion in Myanmar. The elections are being disrupted by terrorism right now. The Western media collectively is going to claim that they are sham elections and never talk about this element of U.S. interference. And the U.S. is doing this here in Thailand. I'm based in Thailand. There's a U.S.-backed opposition here, trying to overthrow the current government and put in its place an anti-China, obviously anti-Russia client regime in its place. And they will, you know, if Myanmar, Thailand, Malaysia is another country being interfered in, even Vietnam, they've been trying, Cambodia. If any of these countries were to just irrationally cut ties with China, yes, it would help isolate China, but it would destroy the economies in this region. They all count China as their primary trade partner, infrastructure partner, increasingly a very important military partner here in Thailand, for example. The majority of their weapons are being bought from China to replace aging Vietnam-era equipment bought from the United States. So it's very important to keep an eye on this and to understand that it's all connected to what's going on in Ukraine. The United States globally is trying to maintain its unipolar global order. They're doing it through proxy war in Eastern Europe. They're also doing it through this type of interference, including terrorism here in Southeast Asia. If you thought this video was useful, please like and share. Think about subscribing. It's free to do. It helps the channel grow. Check the video description below for other places you can find and follow my work. All of the links that I reference will be in the video description below, as will be ways you can help support my work. I don't monetize my YouTube channel. If an ad pops up, feel free to skip it or block it. It's not doing me any good at all. If you do want to help support my work, please do so through Buy Me a Coffee and also Patreon. That is what makes this work possible. And even if you just share my work with others and you help get this information into the hands of other people, that will be greatly appreciated. And that's what makes this work worth doing, knowing that this information is getting into people's hands and that they are using it to shape their perception of reality. Thank you for all of that support. And as always, thank you for watching.